are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, July 22nd, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, revisiting Steve Bannon's promise to deconstruct the administrative state, and in the face of massive protest, Puerto Rican governor says he won't seek re-election but won't resign, and probably later will seek re-election. Meanwhile, Capitol Hill budget deal in the works, punts the debt ceiling 2 years to the next presidential term. Because why put extra pressure on the Republicans? As AOC calls for an investigative commission of family separations, it's a growing mental health crisis amongst migrants as suicide attempts are soaring. Jared Kushner heads to the Middle East, and so what? Iran arrests 17 alleged CIA spies. Richard Neal's primary opponent makes it official. And with the debate, about a week away, it's looking more and more like a four-way race. And Washington braces for Mueller testimony coming on Wednesday. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the show. A little warm in the office today. So you may hear a little bit of sound of some fans. The air conditioning we have just is not capable of performing in this type of weather. It's basically what it comes down to. You have one unit in here, and it's not sufficient.
Seen better days.
We have a couple of days like this every summer. That's just, it's going to be dripping in sweat. That's just the nature of the business.
As if we're not cranky enough already.
Right. I mean, it's not really the nature of the business. Actually, it's one of the things that are generally, specifically not in the nature of the business. You don't want to do a show that's on video and sweat profusely.
You're around electrical equipment.
But yes. But nevertheless, that's what we have. Just a reminder, the AM Quickie is now in your Majority Report audio feed. Check that out. We're going to spin it off to its own feed eventually. It'll be super easy for you to sign up for it. But still working on it. And if you have comments, email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. And we will take your opinions and absorb them. We've made some changes based on comments that we've had and continue to refine. You can say, like, well, I would like this at X amount of time every morning, or Y amount of time every morning, or I'm interested in these type of stories, or this is my general overall feel. Personal preference aside, we won't necessarily, like, if you write, like, I don't like jazz, I like rock. Well, okay. But there are some things that we're responding to. a lot of things to get to today. I want to talk about, I want to revisit something Steve Bannon said years ago now, I guess, at the start of the Trump administration, which does not get sufficient attention in my estimation. But before we go there, let's check in on the job that Republicans are doing trying to clean up the mess Donald Trump made. And, you know, the thing is that you can only go so racist in the Republican Party. And here's why. Because they still need a sufficient number of white Republican women living in the suburbs. And for the most part, apparently, as long as they hear someone say, that's not racist, they're generally okay with it. But sometimes it gets just so obvious. And by so obvious, I mean super obvious. Because even Donald Trump's like, you know, when Donald Trump does it, they can all write it off as it's Trump being Trump. He's being comedic or wacky or really raucous. But when it starts coming out of the mouths, like literally when you have a whole arena chanting something that is racist, it becomes a little bit more concerning. They start to get a little worried. And they send out the whole team. We saw Fox and Friends do this on multiple occasions where they said he's being comedic or there's things are raucous or nobody can be held responsible for their racism. But now they got to send out to even more people, and particularly in Wisconsin. Because remember, there are three states that Donald Trump won that allowed him to win the Electoral College and become president. So one of those people they've sent out this week to sort of really shave off the edges of send them back is Ron Johnson. And Ron's senator from Wisconsin and not very bright.
I have to start by asking you about President Trump's tweet just this morning, continuing his attacks on those progressive congresswomen. Here's what he tweeted in part. I don't believe the four congresswomen are capable of loving our country. Do you agree with the president that they are not capable of loving the United States?
Pause it. Can we just stop here and just think about the absurdity of this question? Capable, like, are they capable of loving? Like, I don't even know what that means. Is anybody capable of loving a country?
Like worse than a thought crime. It's like a feelings crime.
It's weird. It's really weird. But continue.
Good morning, Dana. You know, I would say in general, the whole America love it or leave it is not a new sentiment. You know, back in the 60s, that wasn't considered racist. I just find it very unfortunate that so many parts of our public debate right now are getting immediately stuck inside a racial framework, when what I would like to see is us moving toward that colorblind society. I was hoping when President Obama was elected, it would really go a long way toward healing the racial divide so we can concentrate on these enormous challenges facing this nation, where we really could embrace Dr. King's sentiment that let's judge people on the based on the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. So I would like to see everybody, reduce the rhetoric and let's start dealing with these enormous challenges facing this nation in good faith effort. You know, Dan, I truly believe that Americans, by and large, all have
the same... All right, pause it for 1 second while we get into the pablum, because I don't want to... First of all, the America love it or leave it. He's skipping a step. He's skipping a step or two here in this... One, like the idea that they hate this country, these specific four women hate this country, and that they should all go back from where they came from. Three of them were born in this country. A. But then he's skipping to this whole thing of like, love it and leave it. And we heard it back then when people were protesting against the country. Now, I'll remind you, these are four congresswomen, three of whom have spent previous time in government. These are not people who are going out, and I'm not saying there's any problem with it, but I'm just saying in terms of like drawing the analogy of love it and leave it was used against people who were burning American flags in the streets because of our involvement in Vietnam. They were not Congress people going and proposing bills to make the country more efficient, more humane, whatever it is. These are people by no stretch of the imagination, even on their terms, could you draw that parallel? And then I should also add, if you'll recall, that this love it or leave it came in the wake of the Civil Rights Movement, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, and had a history. Love it or leave it, may have been mainstreamed, but maybe the time to question what was it actually the subtext was maybe back then. Here is a poster. I'm not sure when this is from. Probably back in the 20s, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, somewhere during Jim Crow. And this was actually very close to where Trump had his rally in North Carolina.
What a coincidence. This is Klan country. Love it or leave it. Back in the day, folks.
And look at the little intersectional message underneath it. Help fight communism and integration.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, it's like the opposite of what I want.
There you go.
We want to promote communism and integration.
So,
it meant something totally different back then. Trying to focus on a character first message. Well, we got into all this other mess, but liberals like to play identity politics. I have a question for you,
yeah,
Sam.
Yeah, I don't know. Do we need to hear any more from Ron Johnson?
I have a question for you, Sam.
Yes.
Are you allergic to lavender?
I am.
We already know that, but do you love black people?
Sure. I mean, in general.
Then why do you want to take freedom away from them?
By
taking their freedom away.
By...
Sam, where does freedom come from?
A tree? I don't know. They grow on trees?
Unbelievable. You beta male.
Oh, you're doing that that dude. What's that?
Martin Luther King Jr.
But who's the other guy?
Jesse Lee Peterson Jr.
Jesse Lee Peterson Jr.
Jesse Lee King Jr.
Martin Jesse Lee Jr.
That's an off-ramp from that one.
I guess that's not for the main show.
We should probably save that one.
You should probably become a member to hear more delightful impressions like that.
All right. One more clip of another. This time they brought out a family to basically say to the rest of the Republican Party, you're not really racist. What does Mercedes Schlapp, what does she do? Oh, she's in the press shop for the president. And her husband, Matt Schlapp, is the head of CPAC.
Conservative Union.
Oh, the American Conservative Union, but they run CPAC. And he is the one who said to his formerly good friend, Michael Steele, that he was made GOP chair because he was black. And then, of course, Michael Steele, being extremely sensitive, got upset about that the only reason why he was picked was because he was black, and now they're not friends anymore.
He said Steele needed to show some grace because he's been critical of some of Trump's more conservative policies.
Right, 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 of course. And here is Mercedes Schlapp explaining how the president is not happy at all with the chance that he... that he inspired, sat and paraded around, as they were saying, and then tweeted out and reversed himself. I think somebody tweeted at me that on Friday I may have said he'll disavow it. I mean, if I did, it was completely knee jerk on my part. Of course, he's going to disavow it.
You're talking about the disavow or the disavowed? Disavow?
He was going to disavow the disavow.
Okay, yeah,
retweets are
yes.
Not avowals, okay, guys?
And apparently he did that already. Here is George Stephanopoulos talking about Donald Trump's classic three-step disavowal of the disavowal.
Different way, but you keep talking about how the president disavowed the chant. Just yesterday, and I want to show it up on the screen right now, he sent around a tweet from a woman named Katie Hopkins, which says the new campaign slogan for 2020 is don't love it, leave it, send her back as the new lock her up. Well done to Team Trump. The president retweeted that tweet yesterday. That doesn't sound like he's disavowing the chant.
Look, he made it very clear that he disagreed with the chant, and I will tell you, He stands with those people in North Carolina, across the country, who support him. And why? Because they love America. They know that the president is fighting for them every day. And it's African Americans, it's Hispanics, it's women, it's men. I've been to those rallies. I've been to those events where they say, I love this country. I love the American flag. What are you seeing on the other side? You're seeing the squad dictating the rules of the Democratic Party, which is very clear that they're pushing forward. You know, very disturbing statement.
So, in other words, let me explain what she just said. Yeah, the president heard from Tucker Carlson and Mark Levin that you should not back off this. And so he's back on it. And we're on it. And when you ask me about it, I'm not only going to, in a very sort of like a throwaway way, suggest that he did something, even though the later thing that he did undid the thing that he did, I'm going to now reiterate the whole point of the first thing he did and just do it in the way that I wish he had done it in the first place, so we didn't even have to go through the last two steps.
It's amazing, just the first part of her answer where she pivots from, yes, he does this vote, but also he supports those people who are...
supports those people, and then she goes on to say, and... He also supports his original message that they're horrible. And I don't know if what happened after that, if George Stephanopoulos said later, you just basically said the thing that you just said that you were disavowing.
Right.
The chant.
Look, he made it very clear that he disagreed with the chant. And I will tell you, he stands with those people in North Carolina, across the country, who support him. And why?
Right. I mean, it's absurd. He stands with them and he disagrees with the chant. But that could be like he wanted the chant to last another 10 seconds and it didn't.
There wasn't enough spirit. But I actually think that it's really important when they ask people like this questions on like mainstream cable shows that they be really clear that, as problematic as this country is, that type of racism, that type of demagoguery is very specific to the Republican Party, and it is not mainstream, and it's not normal, and it's not what most people are looking for. Like, and the polls validate that. Like, there's only one segment that responds well to that, and it's definitely not Democrats, and it's not self-identified independents, and even some Republicans claim not to like in the polls. So I don't want for a second them to be able to say like this is about the real America or any of that type of garbage. It's absolutely not true, and there's plenty of people who aren't on the left who don't
this is all about.
I think that's actually quite important.
It's all about motivating the base to get
100%. I'm saying from a mainstream media perspective, in terms of how you say like, hey,
well,
wait a second,
you know, you have to understand the predicament they're in, because they don't want to be bigoted towards these folks. They don't want to be bigoted towards these folks.
In the loudest voice in the Showtime show about Roger Ailes, there's a scene in the first episode where he talks about how we don't want to go for an audience of everybody.
No.
We want to go after a niche which is conservative.
Which is conservatives, exactly. And so fine, that's your propaganda cable network. But this does not represent, there's tons of people who might not be particularly left or woke or whatever. They don't like that kind of talk, and they understand it, and it should be very clear that this doesn't represent some type of norm.
Folks, support for today's show comes from Embark. That's sort of a funny name. Basically, Embark is a service which will help you determine your dog's DNA. It is the most accurate dog DNA test on the market. The Embark Dog DNA Test looks at over 250 breeds and 170 genetic health conditions to help you best care for your dog. I do not have a dog, but old Kelly does. And she has yet to receive it, but this is what she had to say. Embark's testing kit arrived promptly, and the saliva sample was easy and didn't take long to collect. I don't know. I don't know. Do you know if Edie was like a big salivator?
She looked like it.
I sent the sample back in their prepaid and addressed envelope and received confirmation of a receipt soon after. I'm really looking forward to getting Edie's results this week, because even though I think I know what breed she is, The results will include testing for 20 times more genes than other tests, along with her risk for over 160 diseases. This is especially important to me because most of the time it's complete guesswork when it comes to your dog's health. I can't wait to have a good idea of what to look out for as Edie grows up. There you go. I mean, that's a huge issue. Obviously, animals can't tell you what's wrong with them, and they say dogs and cats in particular keep a lot of health secrets until it's too late.
Yep, until it's really expensive.
Yep. Embark is the only company with stellar customer service and vets and veterinary geneticists on staff to talk through your results. Right now, for our listeners, Embark, I like the name, that's funny, has an exclusive summer offer you can't get anywhere else. Go to EmbarkVet.com. That's EmbarkVet.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY to save 15% off your dog DNA test kit. Discover your dog more than fur deep. Visit EmbarkVet.com and use the promo code MAJORITY to save. Do so now. Also, more than 70 sizes, including their signature half cup sizes, Third Love designs bras with breast size and shape in mind for a perfect fit and a premium feel. Just answer a few simple questions via Third Love's Fit Finder quiz to find your perfect fit in 60 seconds. Then, thanks to Third Love's 100% fit guarantee, you can wear, wash, and put your bra to the test for 60 days. If you don't love it, return it, and Third Love will wash it and donate it to a woman in need. Hands down, this is the most comfortable bra you'll own, with straps that won't slip, tagless labels, lightweight, super thin memory foam cups. I do not wear bras, but we had our Chief Majority Report bra tester. She writes, I like that they don't have a zillion options, so it's easy to choose something quickly. The fit is great. I usually have to return most bras I order online, even though they're in my size. I ordered two, both fit. That almost never happens. Super comfortable for an everyday bra, but not as boring as most T-shirt bras. Subtle, cute details, so I don't feel basic. There you have it, folks. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone, and now they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now to find your perfect fitting bra. Get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 15% off today. All right, let's dig into this. Brendan, will you check your IMs? Let's dig into this. This story here. Let's play first this clip. This is Steve Bannon. He's no longer with us. I mean, he's alive, but he's no longer with the Trump administration. He's in Europe. And
he doesn't look super alive, but
he's as alive as he ever was. Let's put it that way. And this is him back in CPAC of 2017. That's over the summer, right, CPAC? And so we're really only talking 5 or 6 months into the election of Donald Trump. And here is what he had to say at CPAC.
Steve.
Yeah, I think the same thing. I think if you look at the lines of work, I kind of break it out into three verticals or three buckets. The first is kind of national security and sovereignty, and that's your intelligence, the Defense Right. Department, Homeland Security. The second line of work is what I refer to as economic nationalism, and that is Wilbur Ross at Commerce, Steve Mnuchin at Treasury, Lighthizer at Trade, Peter Navarro, Stephen Miller, these people that are rethinking how we're going to reconstruct the our trade arrangements around the world. The third...
Pause it. I will note one thing. That, and I'm not sure about Lighthizer, but I have a feeling. What? Every single one of those people that he just mentioned back in the summer of 17, despite the fact that we've had, what, 40 top Trump officials, I'm just pulling that number out of my arse, as it were, but have had to go. The only ones that remain are the ones that he just mentioned.
Around the world. The third, broadly, line of work is what is deconstruction of the administrative state. And if you... So I think the three most important things, I think one of the most pivotal moments in modern American history was his immediate withdrawal from TPP. That got us out of a trade deal and let our sovereignty come back to ourselves. The people, the mainstream media don't get this, but we're already working in consultation with the Hill. People are starting to think through a whole raft of amazing and innovative bilateral relationships, bilateral trading relationships with people that will reposition America in the world as a fair trading nation and start to bring jobs, high value added manufacturing jobs back to the United States of America. On the national security part, it was certainly the first two EOs that you've started to see implemented here over the last couple of days under General Kelly. And that is, the rule of law is going to exist when you talk about our sovereignty and you talk about immigration. General Kelly and Attorney
General... Pause it for 1 second. Just, I want to make something clear. When he's talking about national security, he's not talking about terrorism. He's not talking about anything other than immigration.
Demographics.
He's talking about demographics. And he's talking about militarizing our immigration policies. Okay, good.
He's talking about securing a future for white children.
Attorney General Sessions are adamant, you know, that, and you're going to start to see, I think, with the defense budget we're going to talk about next week when we bring the budget out, and also with certain things about the plan on ISIS and what General Mattis and these guys think, I think you'll start to see the other part of that. But the third, this regulation, every business leader we've had in is saying not just taxes, but it is also the regulation. And I think the consistent, if you look at these cabinet appointees, they were selected for a reason, and that is the deconstruction. The way the progressive left runs is if they can't get it passed, they're just going to put it in some sort of regulation in an agency. That's all going to be deconstructed, and I think that's why this regulatory thing is so important.
We had Dr.
So Mick Mulvaney was also one of those original cabinet appointees who came in at the Office of Management and Budget. And when it became clear that his project of slashing the budget was not going to happen, right? Our spending has skyrocketed, in part, largely because of the tax cuts. This budget bill that they're talking about now will provide no cuts, and they'll kick the debt ceiling 2 years down the road. I'll talk about that later. I just note that so that you can be clear on what they're talking about when their agenda is. It's not about shrinking the size of government in terms of dollars. It is shrinking the capacity of government to make sure that profits are not privatized on the backs of social expenses that we all bear. That's basically what it comes down to. That's what deconstructing the regulatory state means. And we talked a little bit about this story early in the week, but I just wanted to highlight this stuff because it's not being borne out. And I keep thinking about the interview that we did, I think it was in December of 2016, with Sam Bagenstos, who was a DOJ, who was in the DOJ under Clinton and then again under Obama. He said 8 years at the DOJ under the Bush administration not destroyed, but seriously hampered that agency. That it took at least 4 years to rebuild it in many respects. And I think what we're seeing under Trump is a far more severe assault. I think far worse than even that you got under 8 years of Bush. They are looking to destroy these agencies permanently. They're not looking, I mean, remember, they want to cut them, right? They couldn't name them, but they wanted to cut them. But instead of cutting them, what they're doing is they're hollowing them out, which is worse in many respects because we just presume that they're there and that these agencies are functioning to provide us the same sort of governmental services that they have in the past, and they're not. I'd mentioned this story about the USDA the other day. I'm going to reiterate it. The USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Agriculture Department, is leaving Washington, D.C. and moving to Kansas City. Two-thirds, I want you to just contemplate whatever, wherever you work, what would happen if you lost two-thirds of the employees? And particularly ones that are like highly specialized. If you lost two-thirds of the employees over the course of a 2 or 3 month period. So everyone had was given a choice. You either move or you leave the agency. Two-thirds of them declined to move. 99 of 171 employees at the Economic Research Service. This is a federal statistical agency, part of the USDA. Who's going to use federal statistics the most? Other agencies and lawmakers. Where are they located? They're located in Washington. Are they just going to look at a piece of paper? No, they're going to want to sit down with the people who have developed these statistics. They want to find out the nuances behind it, what accounts for this. You meet in person. If you work in any type of business, if you work remotely, you understand the relevance of close proximity, even in this telecommunicating world. Close proximity. At the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, which manages a $1.7 billion portfolio in scientific funding, 151 of 224 employees declined to relocate. This that agency is going to be restaffed with people who have no idea what the agency does, have no history with the agency. Many of these people are scientists who have been there for literally a decade or two. And not only have they been there for a decade or two, they represent decades worth of institutional knowledge because they were trained by people who were there 10, 15, 20, 30 years earlier. And if you've ever been involved with a business that has high turnover, you understand the implications of that. I don't care if you own a restaurant and you have to replace all of your waiters each week. I mean, forget about it. Meanwhile, the Bureau of Land Management is also being subjected to the same thing. It would remove 300 employees from a key Interior Department agency, among them the majority of top managers, and move them and disperse them out west to different states. If I wanted to dismantle an agency, this would be in my playbook, said Steve Ellis, who retired as BLM's deputy director in 2016 after nearly four decades in government service. Transferring so many employees out of Washington could complicate the agency's relationship with Capitol Hill. It's the vast majority of management staff and getting them out. It's important that these agencies have a significant imprint in D.C., said the former head of the agency. Meanwhile, at HHS, Health and Human Services, apparently there's been a decent amount of telecommuting. They come in, I don't know if it's 2 days a week or 3 days a week or how it works. But the idea is that Washington, D.C. is more expensive. People spend a lot of time in their car. A lot of this agency's work does not involve direct communications with staff on the Hill. They still come in, and the agency is now demanding that people come in as a way of putting pressure on them. They have done a survey, and the survey found that many people would leave HHS if they institute this. And it appears that's why they're contemplating doing it. When we talk about deconstruction of the administrative state, the labor secretary. Wait a second, I got two more things. We've seen what's happening with the EPA in terms of regulation. They're rolling back specific regulations. They've also, and I mentioned this briefly the other day, they are eliminating the ability of individuals or community advocates to appeal against EPA-issued pollution permits before a panel of agency judges. Now, industrial permit holders, they can still appeal to this board, but individuals or community advocates can't. So if you want to fight an EPA rule that has been issued now, and you live in a community and you're being, well, here's an example. Emerson Addison, an unemployed English teacher in Clare County, Michigan, last year filed an appeal with the board after the EPA issued a permit to the Muskegon Development Company to inject water into a defunct oil well in Addison's community in an effort to reconstitute the well. I want you to contemplate now what the possible damage could be done by injecting water into an old oil well. If any of you live in a rural area, you understand the implications of this. You have a water supply. There are aqueducts under the ground, or aquifers. And you get stuff into there, you're cooked. Mr. Addison feared that in the process, contaminated water would leak from the well into the local water supply. This is a poor area, he said. Most people don't have the money to fight something like this in court. That's what the purpose of this board was, because anybody could go to the board and appeal a ruling. In fact, in April, the Environmental Appeals Board sent the permit back to the EPA for revision, ruling that it wasn't clear if the agency had sufficiently considered public comments or the effects of the plan on the poor and minority members of the nearby community. Well, that process, gone. Gone. It'll still exist. If you're a permit holder, it just won't exist if you're a community anymore or an individual. Appointing Eugene Scalia to be labor secretary. As you know, he was the son of the blessedly late Antonin Scalia. He has spent most of his career at a white shoe law firm fighting government regulation. He's done legal work for Ford Motor, Steve Wynn Casinos, UBS, UPS, MetLife, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the American Petroleum Institute, the Business Roundtable. Really, I mean, if you wanted a who's who of people, of entities that have attacked labor over the years. In a 2012 profile, Wall Street Journal called him one of the industry's go-to guys for challenging financial regulations. In 2006, he helped Walmart fight against a Maryland law that would have required companies with more than 10,000 workers to either spend at least 8% of their payroll costs on healthcare or pay into a state Medicaid fund. We know why Acosta got fired was because, ostensibly because he gave a sweetheart deal to Jeffrey Epstein. It also turns out that Mick Mulvaney, who is now the chief of staff, right, who's been there since the beginning, who after it became clear that he wasn't going to be able to slash the government's budget because Donald Trump realized, like, you need to pay money out to get elected. He went on to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. There, he's basically shut the agency down. He didn't have the ability to dismantle it, couldn't get Congress to cut its funding, so he basically just stopped all of its enforcement procedures. I don't think they've brought a single enforcement procedure in the past 3 years. So I think largely this is his project. He had chewed out Alex Acosta during a meeting this year. Because, according to the Washington Post, he was dragging his feet on regulation rollbacks desired by business interests and was on thin ice as a result. What else do we have? OSHA has the lowest number of inspectors it's had in decades. It is doing the fewest number of in-depth investigations into the health and safety of workers than anybody apparently can remember. I should just add that the EPA just recently also decided that its investigation into chlorofluorocarbons that creates neurological defects in kids. We're going to go ahead with that one. This is the project, and this is just the ones that we know about. I mean, God knows, we know at the Secretary, Department of Education, all of the regulations regarding for-profit universities and colleges completely roll back. All you need to do is look at the stock portfolios, the stock funds that trade in that, to know how significant that is. The only other thing I can tell you, and the Trump administration is quietly, and this gets to that point about Steve Bannon, when he talks about national security, what he's talking about is literally the hue of national security, like literally the color of our country. Because the Trump administration, according to the LA Times 2 or 3 days ago, has quietly dismantled or cut back multiple programs that were created after September 11th. Oh, they're not going to be spying on people as much? No, that's not what it is. That detect and prevent terrorism involving weapons of mass destruction. In other words, scientists who are developing ways to assess whether a nuclear suitcase is coming in through shipping and whatnot. I would imagine this stuff slowed down commerce in some fashion. They have canceled training exercises. There have been scores of scientists and policy experts who have left. Paul Ryan, not the horrible one, but a retired Navy Rear Admiral, said what we had done in the past was analytically based. What are the threats? Where can we get the most return on the taxpayers' investment for security? He led the Homeland Security's Domestic Nuclear Detection Office, and he said, we're not as secure as we were 18 months ago. So you have all of this assault on the administrative state. Remember, there was also a lot of stories by, I think if you look into Jeff Hauser, I think there was a number of stories talked about how the Trump administration was putting in basically shadow heads at all these agencies. People who did not have to be confirmed by the Senate because they were supposedly temporary, and they've just keep putting in a successive number of temporary heads who are just basically tasked with destroying an agency. This is super easy to understand. Demolition is much easier than building something. Demolition is much easier than maintaining something. You can do demolition wrong, but it only just creates more of a mess or is slightly more dangerous. But in this instance, the danger is not to you. It's to the people who use these services. And the mess, nobody cares. There's one other track on this assault on the administrative state, and this doesn't seem to be going as well for the Republicans, and that's at the Supreme Court. This can change, but we kept talking this year about a couple of cases. One was Kaiser. I might be mispronouncing that. Kaiser. In the past, you've heard me talk about the Chevron doctrine, which is what the court ruled in mid-1980s, where the court determined that when Congress is unambiguous in terms of passing a statute and empowering an agency to carry out that statute, you have to defer to the expressed intent of Congress. But there are times where Congress does not directly address the precise question at issue. So Congress says to the EPA, you regulate any material that is toxic. But they didn't know about compound triple Z. It had not been developed, or people weren't aware of it, or wasn't being in use. And the EPA finds, like, this is toxic, so we're going to regulate it. Congress didn't say regulate compound triple Z. It just said find stuff that's toxic. So if the statute is silent or ambiguous with respect to a specific issue, the question that the court settled was whether the agency's answer is based on a permissible construction of the statute. So it gives wide berth to the agency to sort of assess whether it has authority here.
Not being absolute literalists.
Well,
like, literally do your job, not just because, oh, that doesn't specifically
exactly
say X.
So basically, Chevron says that an agency can interpret a statute unless it's in clear contradiction to what Congress wanted. There is another doctrine called the Auer, A-U-E-R doctrine, that came from a case in the late 90s, Auer v. Robbins, that allows an agency to interpret its own regulation unless it's obviously erroneous or inconsistent. So, in other words, if the agency says, okay, compound triple Z cannot be used in any type of procedure that might allow it to possibly seep into groundwater. And the agency deems, like, oh, wait a second, you're doing construction with this material? We determine that it could seep into groundwater. So the court's going to defer to the agency's ability to make that determination. And this guy, James Kaiser, was seeking disability benefits for PTSD from the VA. The VA in 1983 determined that Kaiser didn't suffer from service-related PTSD. In 2007, the agency reversed its finding, but did not provide him retroactive benefits. Kaiser said the determination of the VA was wrong, and he wanted the Supreme Court to overturn Auer v. Robbins to say that the agency did not have the ability to make that policy, essentially. And the court ended up refusing. Right-wingers have been trying to push this for a long time, and it's not clear to me that they're done. But so on the courts right now, we're somewhat protected, but we'll see. But in terms of practice, it's going to take it's going to take multiple terms of an administration that is committed to rebuilding these agencies so that they can actually just function and do what they're supposed to do. It's hard to build institutions. And once they get destroyed, it's hard to rebuild them. And I don't care whether it's like, you know, the U.S. government short-circuiting institutions in Guatemala, or whether it's Donald Trump's administration and Mick Mulvaney stripping away institutional knowledge and human capital from these agencies that have been built to protect us. So it's something to keep an eye on, and it's something to keep in mind. They're not going to talk about it on CNN when they talk about the implications of this election or anything that the Trump administration is doing. But it's hugely important to just sort of your daily life, particularly if you are a person who is living in poverty or near poverty, or a person of any type of marginal community, or communities that have less political power, or frankly, if you're, you know, anybody who's not a corporation
doesn't want your kid to have brain damage.
Brain damage.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, I don't put a huge amount of stock into maybe I should a bit more into like the kind of Lakoff stuff of like language framing. But I just feel like dismantling the administrative state sounds so much more exciting than, you know, like apartheid and getting food poisoning. Right? Like, there's nothing like that. That sounds so grand and theoretical. This is just Republican deregulation.
Right. Well,
it's just bad for you.
Lawlessness.
Lawlessness, whatever you want to call it. But it is not, it's not like, yes, let's apply like brilliant management theories to the government so it's better. Which I feel like that's sort of like what he's cueing off when he says that. That's like Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich did all of that stuff. I read about how he was always referencing like trendy 90s management theory.
Yes.
So it's like, yeah, here's the bill. We're going to get rid of, you know, pharma regulations to make it easier for heart medication to end up like, you know, exploding your heart or whatever they were doing. And the language is like, you know, like Edward S. Deming showed that you can reinvent the corporation and blah, blah, blah process. And it's like, dude, you're just doing handoffs to corporations.
This,
that's it.
Yeah, this is the, I mean, you know, there was 10 years ago, you know, arguments, libertarian arguments of like the problem is corruption.
Right.
And it's because corporations buy our government. And so the way to keep corporations from corrupting our government is to make the government so small that corporations have nothing to get from them. But this is the point of this is there is a dynamic that's at play here. Someone's going to fill this vacuum. And nature abhors a vacuum. If there is a vacuum of power as to what happens to your average person, corporations will fill it. Period. End of story. And the more you debilitate the ability of our government to react to these things, the more corporate power there'll be. And that's what this is about.
So I say vote third party, no matter what, no matter where you are. I don't care if you're in a swing state.
Wow, you really, you're excited.
That's the perfect coda.
I've been sitting on that one for 40 minutes.
There you go. Honestly, I mean, there's so much at stake.
So I say vote third party.
There's so much at stake. And don't mistake what I'm saying here. I'm not saying that there. First of all, I don't know that there is a safe choice when we're talking about elections. But understand that the functioning of government is far beyond just like I like this person or I don't like that person. I'm going to run for them. And the vast majority of your fellow Americans will not have access to this information. Probably don't care about the information. And then a significant portion of them will also specifically not care Like, I'm sort of aware of what you're saying, and I definitely don't care. I had a conversation with a guy who I like, and plumber. We were talking about the immigration stuff. What?
Wasn't Joe?
No, not Joe. But
hi, Joe. But how does it feel to not be a thing anymore since 2008?
And just the perception of, like, there's a certain amount of just sort of like, I'm going to come up with a very simple catch-all answer so that I don't have to get into the nuance of some of this stuff. And resist that, folks. Understand, it's a massive government because we have 300 million people in this country. Fairly diverse country. Both in terms of, like, geography, psychology, demographics, and to provide for it is a complicated task. And they are dismantling our agencies. And I know it's technocratic and whatnot, but at the end of the day, this is the way that whatever services or ever policies that want to be pursued by whichever of your favored candidates want, this is the way that those things are going to be delivered. And if they're delivered improperly, it's also going to hurt the political agenda. People aren't judged just on the ideas. They're judged on the ability to deliver on those ideas. And between the courts and the agencies, it doesn't matter who you have as president. It's massive obstacles to actually delivering, never mind the politics behind it. Even if you could deliver from a political standpoint and pass the perfect piece of legislation, carrying them out with agencies that have been completely decimated in terms of skills and a legal system that prohibits. I mean, the best part of Obamacare was the Medicaid expansion, and 2 million people didn't have access to it simply because the court decided some badass, batshit crazy ruling that even though Congress could end Medicaid tomorrow and then restart Medicaid with the expanded version of Medicaid, they could not say, if you're going to take Medicaid, state, you need to expand it. But this court is willing to do what it takes to thwart any type of progress. And so these are important considerations. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content virtually every single day. Also, go to justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Don't forget to check our AM Quickie. Gives you some of the top headlines first thing in the morning. And reminder, we're still waiting to find out what the DNA of Kelly's dog, Edie, is. Not just to find out what kind of breed the dog is, but also to give Kelly a heads up that the dog may be susceptible to certain diseases that she's got to keep an eye on going forward. You can discover your dog more than fur deep with the most accurate dog DNA test kit on the market. Right now, for our listeners, Embark has an exclusive summer offer you can't get anywhere else. Go to embarkvet.com, E-M-Bark, as in roof, roof.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Somebody needed to do it.
I couldn't help myself. I kept reading Embark and thinking, EmbarkVet.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY. Save 15% off your dog DNA test kit. Discover your dog more than fur deep. Visit EmbarkVet.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY to save. Also, I think would make a really good gift, actually.
People love their dogs.
Oh, yeah. Dogs are the best. I wish I could have a dog.
Me too. My kids. My kids want to get a...
Why don't you get them a dog?
Because...
Because...
Why don't you get a dog? Okay.
Wait, you get a dog. Because I don't have enough time.
Okay.
Okay.
Imagine your life. Now imagine life. You had to take care of three dogs.
And then there's more things.
The dog, and then the other two.
The other two dogs.
The other two dogs that walk around on two legs. But they want to get... Saul desperately wants a what is known as a teacup dog.
What is a teacup
dog? Or a teacup kitty. Have you heard of this?
No. A tiny one.
They're the size, like you can fit them in your hand.
That is so weird.
They're like the size of like a gerbil.
Yeah.
A little bit bigger.
That's weird. That's too small for a dog.
Saul came up to me and goes, can we get a teacup dog? It costs only $2,000. I was like,
look at the Brooklyn linen schedule,
son. But that... A teacup dog would be something I would become close to be able to do.
I mean, they still need to go to the bathroom just as often.
Yeah, but if I could bring a teacup dog into here, the thing would run around and think it's outside.
That it's real like breezy in here today.
It's like a louder cat.
Well, it's hot outside, too. Better in here than outside. Anyways, check out EmbarkVet.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY to save. Then I can find out if my teacup.
Oh.
That light went out.
This one out.
It just burnt out again. Yeah. All right. Take a quick break.
Tomorrow night, Crystal Ball. Joshua Kahn is back. We're going to do another lesson on the tactics of organizing, and then we're going to have a Hawaiian activist call us from Hawaii about that action that's taking place there. A lot of focus as well as on Puerto Rico. This morning I was on Crystal Ball's Hill Show, if you want to check that out. And for people who subscribe on iTunes, we are now doing little snippets of the Illicit History shows, and the snippet that dropped today was on this our guest Ahmed Cabello on the Sudanese Marxist tradition and what's happening in the Sudan right now. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube.
Jamie!
This week
on the Antifada.
There we go.
This week on the Antifada, I was out of town last weekend, so Sean and Andy held it down with Prank Stallone, a.k.a. Chris James, who you may know as the man who prank called
Sebastian.
That's
really annoying that Chris James went on your show before I got him on Majority Report.
Sorry about that. they talked about screwing with right-wing blowhards on the phone and, you know, the art of pranking. They also talked about a number of topics in the news, including critical mass, bike protests, the RNC in 2004, the insane Jeffrey Epstein affair, and the escalating insanity of the migrant crisis and the struggle against it. And I was especially impressed with what they had to say about that. So check it out. Oh, also, I should say, I'm very excited about this. I just recorded an episode over the weekend with two of the three authors of Feminism for the 99%, a manifesto. Those people being Tithi Bhattacharya, who's been on this show before, and Chinzia Arutza. And, you know, feminism is a topic.
Chinzia Arutza.
Yeah.
Really?
Did I pronounce
that's
it right?
That's an awesome name.
Yeah, she's
cool. I have
no
idea, but that definitely invites that kind of pronunciation.
Yeah, she's from Italy. And they're both super smart, and I love them so much, and I'm so excited to release it on Wednesday.
A literary hangover got one of the Leatherstocking tales by James Fenimore Cooper coming up, but it's not The Last of the Mohicans. It's actually one that's better than that. It's where James Fenimore Cooper basically rewrites his father's founding of Cooperstown in central New York, but does it without any mention of elections, which were actually a pretty big part of life for the elites there. Also, just to mention the Orwell thing, it's kind of apposite. For patrons, I'm doing an Orweller series, so you might want to check that on patreon.com/literary hangover. But George Orwell went to Spain, fought in the Spanish Civil War, got shot in the throat by a fascist, and put on a list by Stalinists for possibly execution, and he came back not saying, hey, man, vote third party, but he said there's hardly a war where it doesn't matter who wins. So I think that's an important lesson.
Indeed.
Listen to Orwell.
All right, folks, quick break, fun half. See you there. left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
Rand Paul. I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook. Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.
Oh, really? Is there a video? Is there a news report? Yeah.